from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the Great Recession and wave of home foreclosures that came with it, home ownership took a beating in the United States. Now renters are taking a beating. A new report finds rents way up as incomes barely move. The rental market has become a big investor opportunity and, for many renters, a hard squeeze. People paying 30, 40, 50% of their income for rent. Others just out on the street. This hour on Point, maybe Jimmy McMillan was right. The rent is too damn high. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the rising rents in your city or town? Are you renting and coping? How? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Back in 2010, New York's gubernatorial race included the unlikely third-party candidate Jimmy McMillan, whose rent is too damn high party pledged to lower rents around the country. Here he was introducing his plan in October 2010.
I represent the rent is too damn high party. People are working 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week with some a third job. Women can't afford to take care of their children, feed their children breakfast, lunch, and dinner. My main job is to provide a roof over your head, food on the table, and money in your pocket.
Well, he was on to something. Last week, here was Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan.
We are in the midst of the worst rental affordability crisis that this country has known.
That's saying a lot. Joining me first in the studio today is Chris Herbert, Research Director at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. He is a lead author on their big report just out on America's rental housing, some are saying, crisis. Chris Herbert, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
What's driving rents where?
Well, what's driving rents up is the fact that since 2007, when we had the Great Recession and the busting of the housing bubble, we've had a tremendous surge in renting. Since that time, we've had the share of households that are renting up by 4 percentage points, with renters increasing by more than 1 million a year over that period, which is historically extremely high. So we've had a huge surge in demand against a supply of housing that hasn't been changing as much, which has been pushing rents up.
But we were told that maybe this was a good thing. Maybe there were a lot of Americans who shouldn't have owned those homes, who had loans that didn't make sense, and maybe the move to renting was a great idea. Now you've got incomes not moving, but rents going way up. That's another kind of squeeze and a rough one.
It is. You know, I think that certainly homeownership is not necessarily the right move for everyone. It is a risky venture, as we've learned all too painfully over the last few years. And for people who are of limited means, who may have unstable incomes, that can be a really risky venture. But on the other hand, being in the rental market itself is also a risky venture, with rents going up and not much option for trying to avoid those rents.
43 million renter households now, 35% of all U.S. households, I'm reading here.
That's correct.
Up 4 million in just the last few years, the highest rate in quite a while right there. And for those aged 25 to 54, rental rates at the highest since your center began keeping records in the early 1970s. What's driving rents up? If incomes aren't going up, what's driving rents up?
Well, I think it's a basic question of supply and demand. When you have that many more renters coming into the market looking for housing, the supply of housing isn't responding as quickly as it might, that's going to push rents up. Even if incomes are low, there's that many more people out there competing for that housing. It will help rents go up.
But has our housing stock shrunk?
No, it hasn't shrunk. I mean, we certainly but it's a question of whether it's owner-occupied or renter-occupied. And one of the things we did see, in fact, meeting that demand was a huge shift of single-family homes from the owner-occupied stock into the rental stock. So mm-hmm. Between 2007 and 2011, we saw 3 million housing units switch tenure. So that certainly helped.
Who owns those houses?
Well, for the most part, it's actually mom-and-pop investors. I mean, mm-hmm. Certainly been hearing a tremendous amount about large institutional investors who have been—
BlackRock, Wall Street, buying up lots and lots of houses.
Exactly. And those people have been important in certain markets in particular. But for the most part, the single-family ownership in terms of the rental market has been with us forever. And it's usually small-scale investors who own one or two units here or there. They're really hard to achieve economies of scale. And so have not been a big enterprise. And so what's new now is the fact that we have seen the BlackRocks and the like entering this market, buying 10 and 20,000 units to try to manage at a larger scale. So that's unprecedented.
And where there were homeowners, you may now have renters. What did you find in your study about the portion of income who is paying for a place to live?
Well, what we've seen actually over the last 12 years, or actually between 2000 and 2011, the last year for which we have good data available, the share of renters paying more than 30% of their income, which has long been the standard measure of affordability, has gone from 38% to 50% and up to 51%. So more than half of renters are now paying more than 30% of their income. And in terms of people paying more than half their income for housing, it went from 20% to 28%. So we have more than a quarter of renters devoting half of their income each month just to pay the rent.
Paint what that means. Make that real for us. When a household is paying 30, 40, 50% of their income for rent, what are the implications?
Well, the implications are pretty pretty broad brush. We looked at particularly at the lower income households who have a tight budget to begin with. And if we look at people in the bottom quartile of the income distribution and compare people who are spending more than half their income for housing with those spending less than 30%. So if they manage to find an affordable unit, we looked at the what they cut back on. And the first thing they cut back on is the expenditure that makes up the biggest share of their budget, which is food. So for people who can't find affordable housing, they cut back 40% on their food spending relative to those with affordable housing. And then beyond that, the next biggest items are transportation, showing that the trade-off people make between finding a house they can afford and having it be located near where they work. And then beyond that, it goes to health care and retirement spending. So we're seeing cutbacks on food spending, which has implications for hunger, cutbacks on health care, and cutbacks on retirement spending. So their well-being now and their well-being in the future is being compromised.
Now, when you look at that lower end, when the rents get to be such a big portion of their income, and we've heard so much in recent weeks about low-wage work, a lot of Americans at that, I mean, that must put a lot of renters very close to the line of homelessness, just on the basis of the rate of rent, the rental rate.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think if you're in that situation where you're looking at, you know, a market like Boston, for example, where rents are well above $1,000, and you know, if you can't find a place that fits within your budget, then there really may not be any other option.
We're looking here at median gross rents up 6%. I'm reading median renter income down 13%. That's a yawning chasm.
That is. And those are in real terms looking at between 2000 and 2012. So, you know, if you look at that in the line graph, it's just rents are going up, incomes are going down, and that chasm is growing.
So historically, at least for some decades now, we thought, well, when that opens up, there'll be some kind of affordable housing that will come into play or rent subsidies through the government somehow that might come into play. What about that front?
Well, you know, what we've seen since the recession, there was some increase in spending on assisted housing, primarily through the housing voucher program, which is our main means these days of expanding assisted housing. But what we've seen is that spending has been eaten up by the fact that renters' incomes have gone down, rents have gone up, so the per renter subsidy has gone up. So we've not been able to increase the number of people who have assisted, even at the same time that the number of people eligible has gone up. So, you know, a few years ago, about 27 or 28% of people who were income eligible for assisted housing managed to find a unit. Now it's down below 24%.
And the sequester has just made that bite harder.
In the past year, in 2013, HUD estimates that the sequester had a cutback of 125,000 in the numbers of housing vouchers issued. And so at a time when the demand or the need for this was really going up, we were actually cutting back on how many people we were helping.
Chris Herbert, stand by for a moment. Diana Olick joins us now from Washington. She's real estate correspondent for CNBC. Diana Olick, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you see in these numbers? Rental rates up significantly, incomes not up significantly. What about the pinch? What do you see here, Diana?
Well, I see a lot of people continuing to have to rent, whether it's people who were homeowners before and lost their homes to foreclosure and don't have the credit, or whether it's those potential first-time homebuyers who simply don't have the down payment or the credit level to get a mortgage to get into today's housing market. We still see a lot of negative equity that keeps people stuck in place. We still see people who are just unable to get into that move-up market. So, you know, we've been calling it kind of this renter nation. On the one hand, it's younger Americans who just can't get into home ownership. On the other hand, it's also younger Americans who don't want to get into home ownership because they've seen what's happened to their parents. They've seen, in some cases, what's happened to their childhood home during the housing crash.
Yep.
And they also want to be very mobile. And that's another part of it, is that today's young worker needs to be able to go where that job is. And they want to be able to go to where that better job is as well. And that means renting, and often it means renting in city centers or as close to the city as possible. Because as you know, younger generations now are far more social, far more, you know, technologically advanced, and they want to be able to move whenever they can, and that just goes toward renting, and that's where you're seeing that incredible demand.
But if rent goes up and up, I mean, at some point, historically, part of the reason people bought homes was to protect themselves from that kind of thing, to lock in a certain rate of spending on housing. If you're always in the rental market and rents are going up and up and incomes aren't, it doesn't look so attractive, Diana.
No, it certainly doesn't. And that's why we see people tend to double up and triple up and a lot of roommates and folks living together. But also, I have to say, this new single family rental home trade, which we're seeing so much on the investor side, which is what I cover so much, is offering more housing stock. I mean, there are 4 million more single family rental homes today than there were back in 2006. And while rents can go up there as well, it's at least offering some new housing stock to get those who might have been foreclosed on before into homes and out of apartments. We are seeing more multifamily apartment stock that will come onto the market in 2014, 2015. And believe it or not, some of the investors are already talking about it being too much stock and that rents might start to come down. So we could see some easing over the next 2 years. But right now, you're right, it hurts.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American rents going up and up while American incomes do not, and what's going on in the American rental housing market. Diana Olick is with us from CNBC, real estate correspondent there. Chris Herbert is with us from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, lead author of America's Rental Housing, Evolving Markets and Needs. That puts it mildly. When you look at the numbers, they look pretty rough. If you're in that rental market, you know it. Diana, when new property comes online, new units come online, are they likely to be for low-income Americans? We see an awful lot of activity in high-income property construction.
Well, I'll tell you, certainly not around here in Washington, D.C. I mean, you see all kinds of apartments going up all over the place, but they are in, you know, very exciting new neighborhoods with very high price tags. You don't see as much of that affordable housing that we need to have. I know the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development was at that conference from Harvard's Joint Center, which you were talking about before, and he was saying that they need to have far more affordable rental housing and that the government right now is trying to get investors into that of it, trying to lure them in with some incentives, some tax incentives. But quite frankly, from what I see on the REIT side, that is the real estate investment trusts, you know, it's A locations and A buildings, and that's where the apartment investors want to be. They want to be where you're going to get that high rent, where you're going to have city center, you're going to have people who are willing to come in and pay that. And remember, you do also have empty nesters who can afford to get in and pay some of these higher prices, and that's where so much of the housing stock is. But as you say, for the younger folks, for the people who don't have that high income, don't have that higher wealth, you know, they're really stuck in a situation. They may have to go further out of the city, further into the suburbs or exurbs to find those rental housing that they can afford.
I mean, one wonders how they could ever, if they decided one day they did want to own, how do you save when the rent's so high that you're pouring maybe half your income into it, Diana?
You certainly don't. And knowing now that you have to have such a high down payment for some loans, of course, the FHA still exists at 3.5% down payment, but they have much higher insurance premiums right now. We learned, you know, just recently the FHA has dropped dramatically in market share because they raised their fees and their premiums and because they actually want to reduce their market share. They feel like they are too much in the housing market, although they really did help save financing for a lot of lower-income folks. So it is impossible at this point for some folks to save that large enough down payment to get into home ownership. So, again, it's going to be going further out of city centers. It's going to be, you know, heading into B or what they call B or C neighborhoods that are not as expensive. And then, of course, just waiting for more of that housing stock to come online.
Chris Herbert, are we in a new normal here? Or simply, people are going to be asked to pay more out of pocket for their housing, for their rent, which locks them out of getting into ownership. And I guess the rents go up along with ability to pay, maybe faster than ability to pay.
Well, I think we're finding our way to a new normal. We've had a period of time when there really has been hard to say what is normal. 10 years ago, when we had the boom in housing, we had a lot of people moving into home ownership who were probably lured by the rapid run-up in prices trying to make a quick buck, who were probably not suitable for owning homes at that point in time. We've had a major adjustment now, both in terms of what's been happening in the housing market and what's been happening in the economy. And so I think the pendulum has swung too far the other way. And so I think we will come back to a point where there's more of a normal market as the economy heals in part and as prices come back into an equilibrium. That said, we've had this affordability problem in rental. It's as bad as it is now. It has been a problem for a long time. It's gotten mm-hmm. worse. But if you go back even 10 years when we had 40% of people paying more than 30% of their income for housing, it's hard to say that that was a good situation either. So,
what is a normal market on the other side of this crisis? Maybe that's just shifted. Let's bring our listeners in from San Francisco. Muncie's calling. Hi, Muncie. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I've heard this discussion a number of times. Before the current economic situation, I do not have a problem finding rent and a job that could pay enough for it. Through it, and now at the tail end of it, still haven't had a problem. Most of my friends are the same way. We're all in our, lower 30s, and we've been living single lives for a while. And I've lived in some pretty expensive cities, Manhattan and now San Francisco. I think that there needs to be more of an accountability for young people for the money that they're bringing in and how they're spending it, as opposed to everyone just sitting around complaining like, oh my God, the rents are going up, but my pay isn't.
You think they're wastrels, Muncie. They're just going out to the bars. I mean, you're in San Francisco. We read all these stories about San Francisco young people, piling into apartments, 5, 6, 7, 8 more people in one housing unit, Muncie, because they can't afford it, even with the high-tech jobs there.
It is affordable. That's the point that I don't understand. I mean, San Francisco is actually more expensive than Manhattan, and it is still affordable. I have about an 800-square-foot apartment. It is not rent-stabilized, and I'm paying $2,800 for it, and I don't have a problem doing that, especially in larger cities. You don't have to have a car. You don't have to go out drinking every night. You don't have to be shopping every single day. Every weekend will do.
Muncie, we've got it, and stay safe and warm right there in your apartment. What do you say, Chris? It's affordable, $2,800 a month, and no problem for Muncie, our caller.
Well, so if we do the math, $2,800 a month, if that's going to be about a third of your income, then you're probably making $7,000, $8,000 a month in income times 12. So you're talking about somebody making $85,000 to $100,000 a year in income. That's at the upper end of the income distribution in this country. The median renter makes less than $32,000 a year. 22% of renters make less than $15,000 a year. And when you're working full-time year-round at the minimum wage, that's about what you're making. So if you're talking about low-wage workers in this country who are making $15,000 to $30,000 a year, in order to find a rental you can afford, the rent needs to be between, say, $400 and $800 a month. That's a far cry from $2,800 a month.
Muncie in San Francisco, count your blessings. And thanks for your call. Austin in Williamsburg, Virginia, other side of the country. Austin, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I completely disagree with your the last caller. I'm 2 years out of college, and my rent just went up 10% this month. Or excuse me, this year when I renewed my lease.
Okay.
And obviously my wages have not raised to meet that, and I've had to make cutbacks pretty much all across the board to be able to live where I'm continue to live where I'm living now.
So up 10%, but your income has not gone up 10%. What percentage of your income do you reckon you spend on rent, Austin?
It depends on the week, but usually between 29 and 38% of my income.
And is it a problem because you're out doing fancy shopping and drinking every weekend instead of saving your pennies?
No, I have cut back on my money that I use to go out, but it's hurt my. I have car repairs that I need to get done, and I'm not saving enough money to repair my car. I've had to cut back on utilities. We've cut back on internet speeds and things like that. I mean, it's just been across the board, and my roommate's having more problems than I am because he's not making as much as I am.
Yeah. Cut back internet speed, and life these days goes into slow motion. Austin, I appreciate your call. Good luck there. Chris Herbert, Dinah Olick, please stand by. Susan Wachter joins us right now from Philadelphia, professor of real estate, financial management at the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania. Susan Wachter, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Put this moment in historical terms for us here.
and what Americans are up against. You know, do we deserve to be complaining, or is this the way it's been in different phases in the past? Is this tougher, this pinch, this rental pinch, Susan?
This is tough. This is tougher than it's been in a generation. Whether we deserve to complain or not, of course, is a whole other matter. Whether complaints are going to get an answer is a whole other matter. I do think there's a new normal ahead of us, and the new normal is that it will cost more to rent as a percentage of income. Rental will be less affordable. I agree with Diane Olick that we do have perhaps a bit of excess supply coming on the market in the short run, but I do think that rents are longer term going to exceed inflation. We've been in that new normal for some years now, so I think we're going to be back on trend of that. So what does that mean? That means rent is lacking affordability, and then to your point, it becomes difficult to save for a home, which has been the way of hedging against rent increases.
And not just hedging, but that was, at least when it worked, that was the way in which most Americans, if they ever accumulated any capital, it was there in the value of their home. They kind of got to play in the equity game of this economy. Without that, Susan, I mean, if they're paying such high rent that they can't save, that they can't ever buy, and we've seen all the charts that show how income and capital are concentrating at the top, it seems kind of like a top-down rigged property game.
Well, there are, of course, ways to overcome this individually, and that means attempting to push against all of these problems and save more. And that's going to have to be, in part, the solution. But at the same time, if wages don't keep pace with housing prices and rents, and we certainly have seen that trend, it makes it more difficult.
Diana Olick, there's talk about upzoning as a way of dealing with this. What is upzoning, Diana?
Upzoning?
Yeah.
I don't know.
who can help me here? Upzoning?
I can help you there.
Yeah.
Upzoning is allowing for more density, and it is one of the solutions.
Ah.
So allowing for more density, particularly where density is a win-win across the board in center cities where you've got transit-oriented development nearby, you've got access to transit, you've got access to jobs, that is a solution. Of course, there's always a question of, yes, this is good, but is it really good in my backyard? It's got to be designed. It's got to be done well. But our cities have lost population, and there's room to bring population back, and there's a demand for city living.
But I'm reading here a piece in the Washington Post, Chris, that say, you know, what's happening is boomers who did well in the property market, selling those homes, the big homes in the suburbs, moving into the city, and then they don't want more density because they want a comfy environment in the city, sort of resisting the zoning change that might help bring rents down, Chris.
Well, you know, we've had a NIMBYism issue, but not just in the cities, but certainly in the suburbs, that goes back a long way. So that's not a new issue in terms of people wanting to keep their area where they are, low density and the like. So I wouldn't put the blame entirely on the baby boomers moving back to the city. We do want to have rental housing that's available not just in the city, but also in the suburbs where many of the jobs have moved to as well. You know, I think there are concerns that when part of this density increase is to restrict lower requirements for parking, because that's a big part of the cost. And so there are, you know, spillover effects on the surrounding neighborhood. They have that many more people looking for spaces in your neighborhood. So
we're looking at American rents going up and up. Chris is calling from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. A longtime listener.
Great.
I just wanted to give a landlord's perspective.
Yeah.
I'm one of those mom-and-pop landlords that you were talking about. In 2008, I got a couple of three-family houses in Bridgeport, along with my father, as an investment properties. I lived in one for a little bit.
Right.
I moved out recently. It's really not that profitable for me to be a landlord as it stands. Don't get me wrong. I do make money.
Yeah. Okay.
But I am looking to offload a house right now. Actually, I'm making between $10,000 to $15,000 on a good year. I'm netting from it, and my rents are probably 10% below average in the area.
Okay.
I figure I could always raise my rents, but my tenants have trouble paying their rent as it is. So, what would be the point? All of my tenants have had problems paying rent over the years. And I don't see them living extravagant lives. I see them in low-paying jobs. And it would be really nice if, you know, there was a living wage to help some of these people to have a little cash to, you know, make ends meet.
Including helping you out as a landlord in that situation, Chris. What's the demand for your triple deckers, your three families like? Are you moving them? Are they on the market?
There's an average of like 2 to 3 months between tenants moving out. 2 months if I'm lucky. And that's 2 months without rent for me. And my average tenant stays like a year and a half. There's a very high turnover rate. So I'm never having a year where I'm at full capacity for all my units.
Yeah.
Add that to a 1 month finder fee for my management company, which is the only thing I sub out. I do all the repairs myself and I handle all the complaints myself. It's money, but I figure I could make more money, say, if I took the money from this house and used it to buy another house to flip, because I do contracting myself.
We're renting and we're flipping, and it doesn't sound like easy street, but you're in it, Chris. We wish you luck with that. I mean, Susan Wachter, right there, one would think that if incomes are not up, at a certain point, there is a built-in break on rents. I mean, they can only go so high if incomes don't rise, Susan.
Not true. Chris exemplifies the challenge ahead of us. Rents can increase, and rents can increase a lot faster than income. There's no market law that stops that. What it means is that people are more pressured to pay more of their income in rent, double up more, choose smaller properties. We actually have more affordable housing today, to date, than most European countries do. And I see us going the way of some other countries where rent is hard to believe, but actually less affordable than in the United States.
What about the impact of the big, Chris is a typical, maybe small buyer of rental property, mom and pop style. What about the big buyers, Blackstone and others? We've talked to them here who saw a big opportunity and I think have seen pretty big equity gains on when they scooped up lots of single family houses, plus apartments. What's their business model for residential property going forward, Susan?
Well, I actually think that it has a transformative possibilities right there. The Blackstones of the world moving into this investment opportunity seems to have been doing quite well. It's making a difference. It's still a small percentage, but it's making a difference. But where is it likely to make the key difference is in professionalizing the services related to maintenance of single-family rental housing, making those networks of managers that Chris uses, but also repair people, making that more professional, perhaps, in fact, even more efficient. This is a competitive market, but there's room to bring it into a more technology-savvy world, and I think that's what's going to happen. That's going to, besides a lot of profits being made, I think it's going to transform the industry.
Diana, are those big firms, Wall Street firms, happy so far with their entrance into this whole business of buying and renting out?
Most of them certainly are, and I just wanted to add that, you know, we're doing a story right now about Blackstone starting yet another venture, which is called Buy to Rent, where Blackstone is actually lending to small to mid-size other investors who are limited because Fannie and Freddie only lend a certain amount of investment properties per person. So now Blackstone is allowing loans of up to $50 million to get more investors into the market, even though they themselves have put over $5 billion into the single-family rental trade. So whereas some people thought, well, that market was cooling a little bit, some investors might be deciding to, you know, take their gains and sell off some of the houses, the investors that I speak to say they are in this for the long haul, they're buying more properties, they're seeing that rental stream, they're getting economies of scale, they're also starting to see profit off of this.
Diana, hold the thought. We're up against a break right here. I want to come back to that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American rents going up and up, while American incomes do not. And what's going on in the American rental housing market? Chris Herbert is with us from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. They're just out last week with a big study on exactly what's going on and the rising portion of income that Americans are spending on rent in this post-Great Recession period. Susan Wachter is with us from the Wharton School of Business, professor of real estate and financial management there. And Diana Olick is with us, real estate correspondent for CNBC. Richard in Montgomery, Alabama. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much.
Yes.
just offering a personal anecdote related to what a previous caller was saying about cities like New York and San Francisco being quite affordable and not understanding why someone would complain. I was living in New York for nearly 5 years. I was working as an editor at a reasonably well-respected international magazine.
Yeah.
And I found that the cost of living there was so high that I have now ended up in Alabama, one of the many reasons that I've come back here. But anyway, you know, there was a point in time where I was paying more than 100% of my income on a fifth-floor walk-up apartment in downtown Manhattan.
That's hard to do.
It is hard to do. Fortunately, I had a touch of family help. But, you know, what I ended up settling into was an apartment in Brooklyn that was previously a closet. It was 5.5 feet wide by 9 feet deep, and I was still paying 60% of what I was bringing home every month. So I think that what I'm seeing amongst, you know, people of my own age group, say 25 to 30, there are a lot of people that are finding they can work remotely, moving away from places like New York City and places like San Francisco, where it's tough to find something, anything, for less than $1,500 a month. And moving to places like Chapel Hill, Chattanooga, San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, places like that that are slightly more affordable, good-paying jobs, but just not quite as tough as places. Like
Richard, I hope with your move you have a place bigger than 5 by 9. I mean, that's not an apartment size; that's a cell size.
I've done a little bit better than that. I'm now in a townhome, a 3-bedroom townhome. I'm paying significantly less than I was for a fifth floor walk up. I'm paying a bit more than I was paying for this closet sized room.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it's all quite good. And what I found with the work that I'm doing, as a journalist, it's quite easy to be remote. Most of the work that I was doing in New York, I was having to travel for. And I'm still doing essentially the same type of work. But I'm just not basing myself in a place like that. And there are plenty of people that I grew up with who have moved off to other big cities, and they're essentially doing the same thing and finding they can settle somewhere else and travel a good bit for the work and actually save a little bit of money for once.
Just a long way from Times Square, but with a lot more room to stretch out. Richard, I appreciate your call. Diana Olick, what about that as a solution? Just move. Rent's too high? Move.
Well, that's what we were saying before is, you know, you've got to move either farther out of the city or move to another market where you know that the rent is going to be more affordable. What a lot of folks also are doing is moving back in with family. And we saw that during the housing crash when people were unable to buy or whether they were foreclosed on, et cetera. Now, you know, younger Americans simply aren't moving into rental housing. They're staying in their parents' home after college. And what's so interesting is we're seeing this huge trend in the home builders building these multi-generational homes, that is, having really separate apartments, whether it be for parents or for children, in a home so that you can have different generations living under the same roof and making it more affordable.
So, move in with mom, dad, or cousins, or who knows how many these days. Allison in Somerville, Massachusetts. Allison, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm a single parent in Somerville, and I'm currently paying over 40% of my income in rent. And that is after a good friend kind of took my son and I in. So I pay, I kind of rent space from her, and she is the renter. But one of the things that isn't mentioned is that if you have a child under 6, you have to have a lead-free apartment, and those are basically unicorns. And because they're so rare, the price seems to be, you know, marked way up.
Yeah.
So there are.
So to find that you've come under the wing of a friend, and even paying rent to a friend, it's 42% of your income, Allison.
Yeah, to make it work so that we could get something lead free.
Yeah. Good luck to you. I appreciate your call, Chris. This gets to the issue of quality of housing and where people on modest incomes are being pushed in order to get by. Allison was lucky enough to find something lead-free, but people are up against it here.
Yes, and that's another one of the trade-offs that we see them have to make, which is if I can't find a house that's a decent house and I can afford, then I'll take one that's less than decent. And so one of the things we see is people who pay less than 50% of their income for housing often have more quality issues as well.
Susan, let me read you. Richard called from Montgomery, Alabama, but he's making out better there than in New York anyway. But here's Tim writing from Durham, North Carolina. He says, working for a property management company this last summer, it was amazing to see how many 50-something doctors, lawyers, software engineers have turned to buying up housing while the market is down and renting those properties out as a source of income. Tim writes to us, for some, this is just how they plan to finance their retirement. Fair enough, it's their money to use, he writes, but I feel jaded watching a legion of well-off boomers buying up all the cheap housing in the area, driving prices up and making starter homes scarce. If this gets pervasive enough, it will mean the formation of a rentier class at the top and a nation of workers paying a third plus of their wages to that class monthly at the bottom. What about it, Susan?
Well, there are these trends of inequality that are affecting income, and this trend is going to add to it. I want to take these two calls that we've gotten and point to another kind of new normal, and that's been referred to by some as the big sort, which is sorting people geographically by what neighborhoods they can afford. And historically, of course, cities have been where we've had a disproportionate number of lower-income families living. That's changing. It's changing as we speak. New York is becoming far less affordable. It's already not affordable. The first-tier cities, San Francisco, obviously, we're still not in the European mode where London is simply not affordable to anyone unless they're quite wealthy. But this big sort is new for America, and I believe it is the new normal. So it's a kind of inequality that has impact for geographical decisions. If you want to be in New York, you need to be multi-generational. You need to be doubling up, tripling up if you're young and starting out.
The big sort. On the other hand, we're reading, Susan, that Americans... I mean, Diana rightly points out that many young Americans are mobile and need to be and want to be, but overall, I've been seeing reports, Susan, of Americans being less geographically mobile, less ready to just pick up and move.
There's that, too. The mobility is down. Part of the reason mobility is down is simply because the housing market has been in a no-go situation. If your mortgage is if you're underwater, if your mortgage is higher value than your home, you're not moving. Younger people are moving. For a while, of course, there weren't jobs. There are now jobs. People are moving. But still, mobility overall is lower than it has been. It's difficult to mortgage. If you can't get a mortgage and you're not moving to a new home, if you don't have a job, you're looking for a job, you're living with your parents, you're not moving. But things are easing up in mobility. I expect that to increase, but still, choices are going to be more difficult.
Travis in Chickasha, Oklahoma. Travis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. My point is I heard that somebody was describing an 800-square-foot apartment in San Francisco as at $2,800 a month as affordable. Well, I just wanted to make the point that I have a 3-bedroom brand new house and my mortgage is less than $1,000. So the idea that $2,800 for anything less than a 2-story brick house is a month is ridiculous to me.
Right. Travis is slapping his forehead in Oklahoma, Diana, while our caller from San Francisco was happily paying $2,800 for 800 square feet and not feeling too pressed by it. I mean, there's your point of, you know, go where it's cheaper, maybe.
No, I mean, it's all your perspective. Look, it depends on if you grew up in a big city and you're used to seeing those incredibly high rates. I mean, some folks say, oh, my God, mortgage rates are going up right now. Well, I bought my first apartment on a 9% mortgage, and I thought that was darn good.
Mine was 18% my first, if you can believe
it. Well, there you go. It's all percent. It's all your perspective of where you're living, whether you're going to live in a big city where you know that rents are going to be high, or if you're in New York or San Francisco or Washington or wherever, you're just going to expect that. Look, we're seeing this new trend in those micro apartments now that they're building in D.C. and New York, where it's basically a closet, and you're going to pay over $1,000 a month for that, and people are all excited about those coming onto the market. I would just add one thing, though. Something that was said earlier in the show is that home ownership is a hedge against higher rents, against your rates going up. I would argue that that's not really the case anymore. Even taking it outside of the housing boom and the crash and prices falling down, you know, people are still using adjustable rate mortgages. People are still looking at the possibility of home prices on a roller coaster, going up quickly, going down quickly. And I don't think that's going to end immediately when everything is supposedly recovered. The way people are using housing right now, using home equity lines of credit, expecting these gains, I don't think you can see it as a hedge anymore.
Because it can go down as well as up, as we've learned, and so
exactly.
There's risk in it.
Let me just jump in here.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's not a hedge if you are using it to speculate for those gains, flipping. You know, if you're buying a home to sell it for your investment gain, and don't disagree, many people are doing that. But that's the point of the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and home ownership. It is a way of staying in the community long-term, having access to that job, and not being pushed out by rent increases or by mortgage increases. You have a security that is a factor of the way the mortgage market is set up. Availability of the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage allows that stability and that hedge against rent increases for people who can afford homes. And, of course, we're seeing that affordability being eroded as well.
Susan, what about...
Diana, please argue that one point for a second. Mm-hmm. You saw the 30-year fix get very popular in the last couple of years during the crash. That's basically all anyone was doing. But in just the last couple of months, as mortgage rates have started to rise, we're seeing an enormous jump in the number of people using adjustable-rate mortgages again. And those adjust up and down, and they will likely adjust up over the coming years. And home values, again, whether you're planning on selling or flipping or not, you cannot depend on that home value rising forever.
A hedge, if you can get a nice long mortgage at a rate you can afford and stay there. Susan, what about the implications of higher rates of rental housing, including single-family homes that were traditionally owner-occupied, for communities? Does it change the flavor of a community when you've got many more renters, Susan?
Yes, it does. And that's one thing that we have seen is pretty substantiated in the research. Home ownership, homeowners do contribute more to the community. They're there. They have a stake in the community long run. That's why these issues of rising rentership, of course, we need to have good renting opportunities, but why these issues go beyond single individual households to bigger societal questions of where are we going to get those people who are going to build communities for the long run if we threaten home ownership overall, if we're in a whole new world. We're not there yet. We still have a majority of people who are able to become homeowners, and hopefully policy will continue so that we have the basics that allow that, including fixed-rate 30-year mortgage.
Kevin in Evansville, Indiana. Kevin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My question is, there was an earlier comment about that the majority of homeowners that are renting out right now are mom-and-pops. And my assumption, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most of those mom-and-pops would be either upper-middle-class or upper-class families. And my question is, how much of the rise in rental prices is likely from them passing the buck as they see raises in their cost of living and in their taxes onto the renter to supplement those rises that they're seeing?
So the cost of living for more affluent families driving rental rates, what do you think, Chris?
Well, I was interpreting what he was saying, meaning that their costs of running that operation, as Chris was talking about, are going up. And certainly if property taxes are going up, if your cost of capital is going up. I mean, I think most of those mom and pops, I think Chris was painted a pretty telling portrait of what it's like for that kind of a business, where you are getting squeezed by your own renters who are struggling to make ends meet. They're trying to juggle their lifestyle. They're moving every year and a half. He's facing those vacancies.
Turnover.
So
it's
not necessarily an easy life. And I don't think that we should necessarily think about those landlords as rapacious. I think they're trying to get a decent return on providing a very important commodity for people. And I think we do need to make sure that they have the kind of supports that they need, that we have incentives to make investments in those housing, that we have property taxes and the like that aren't too onerous when you're trying to rent to people of modest means. So I think there's a lot more we could do to support those mom and pops.
Susan, is it somehow part and parcel of an economy with more concentrated wealth and income that it will turn toward an ownership class and a renter class more deeply?
Yes and no. A lot of the mom and pops are actually small entrepreneurs who may, in fact, be first-generation immigrants who are renting to others. Mm-hmm. It's not all of one piece here. It's a way of actually getting a leg up and becoming part of the middle class by starting young with
one apartment if you can do those savings. Now, you're not going to be able to do it in New York City, mm-hmm. but in a city in, you know, in Alabama, just as we've heard, this mm-hmm. is a way up. It's not easy, but it is one way of becoming an entrepreneur, and many have done so and will do so going forward.
And Diana, do you think we head back towards some kind of familiar equilibrium here as some more stock comes online in coming years, or what about the idea that we're in a new normal?
Well, I absolutely do think that we are going to see moderation in rents. We are already seeing them. While higher, they're not jumping as much as they were in the past couple of years. And as I said earlier, we're going to see a lot of new rental stock coming into the market in big cities like D.C., New York. I mean, no matter where you look around here, you see cranes, you see this new volume coming up, and that's because lending to multifamily developers has eased up quite a bit, and that was the trouble during the recession, was that people who wanted to build new rental stock couldn't because they could not get the financing for it. Now investors are saying it's there, they're seeing more, and we will see that come onto the market, and that will bring those rents back to a steadier rate.
Well, there's some light on the horizon, but with all the changes we've seen in the economy, we'll watch very carefully to see exactly how that actually turns out. Diana Olick, it's always great to have you, a CNBC real estate correspondent there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Diana.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Wachter at the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Susan.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And Chris Herbert at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University that did the big study. You can link to it at our website. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.